morning, everyone. We're going to get started. Thank you all for coming. We're beating the snow, I hope. We're very excited that Catherine Girard has agreed to be here today to kind of follow up on a conversation we had in December. So Catherine serves as the Associate Director of Executive Education Programs and Director of the Program for Advancement of Research and Conflict Collaboration at the Maxwell School. Before joining SU, Catherine was Assistant Director for the New York State Governor's Office of Employee Relations, where she led a consulting and training organization devoted to statewide training and organizational effectiveness. Catherine teaches leadership for managers at many levels. She recently conducted training for senior executives in the Department of Defense and New York State government. She co-developed and delivered a workshop entitled Leadership and Learning for almost 8,000 managers in federal and New York State agencies. Her current government customers include the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office and the New York State Department of Health. Catherine holds an MA from the University of Toronto, an MPA from Rockefeller College, and has completed substantial graduate work in the field of education. Please join me in welcoming Catherine Girard.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you this morning, and hi to a lot of friends out there. Thank you for coming. I have a slightly different title, but I promise I will cover the areas in the other title. I think a broader framework for what I want to do is really about bridging understanding. And I'll be talking about three things that I think people have to pay attention to if, in fact, they want to bridge understanding. And those three things are framing, conflict styles, and use of specific conflict skills. Just a little bit about PARC. PARC is a research and practice center that deals with conflict and collaboration. These are pictures of some projects we've done in Jordan, in Belize, and obviously we have projects in the United States where we're dealing again with crossing the divide. So in one case, we have Jordanian olive growers who are going to be working cross-border in Israel. In the case of Belize, it's environmental leaders who are in conflict with the communities as well as government. And so we do a lot of practice work as well as theory work. And what I'll be presenting this morning is actually not that dissimilar from the work that we do abroad. And I should say that this talk has many variations, and the latest variation of this was done after the last presidential election when students at the Maxwell School organized a teach-in. And the nature of what they wanted me to talk about is how do I have a productive conversation with people who voted differently than I did? And it was tough for some of the students because they were saying, you know, these are people I love. These are my grandparents. These are aunts and uncles. These are my neighbors. And yet I'm angry and I'm really upset. So how do I have a productive conversation that maintains relationship, but at the same time allows me to stand for what I want to stand for? So that's really in some ways how I want to frame this, because I think we're talking about civic discourse, we're talking about how do we have productive citizenship, and so I think this has never been more important for us than it is right now. So I'm going to start again, as I mentioned, with framing, and to some degree, this is about your choice. I'm not going to claim that you have to bridge a divide. You don't have to bridge a divide. But one of the key questions is whether or not your communication is about framing your message effectively and communicating it, which is really advocacy, and there's nothing wrong with advocacy, but that's really different than what I'm talking about, which is where The challenge of framing is to understand how others frame the situation, how to understand it, and how to really deal with it, how to be open to it. So I really want to start with that. And in a minute, I'm going to ask for some active audience participation. So let me start with an event that you probably know about, I hope you know about, and then I'm going to show you some pictures and ask you to sort of yell out what you see in the picture. So this is the neutral picture. This is simply, as you can see, this is a story about the Dakota Pipeline, and what you're seeing, of course, is literally a pipe being stuck in the ground, and that pipe is going to be transferring oil from North Dakota to Illinois. Here's potentially one framing or story about the pipeline. So as you see this, what is this a story about?
Disaster.
Well, that's your framing. What's their framing? So if you read how they're framing this.
Progress.
Yeah, this is about progress. This is about efficiency. Okay, now here's the next one. How are these people framing the same event?
Also disaster.
Yeah, so for them, this is about the environment, right? And this is about a potential environmental disaster, right? That this could affect water. So that's another framing of this. How about this one?
Land rights.
Sovereignty rights, indigenous rights, right? Respect for indigenous rights.
You know, it's also about priorities.
Absolutely. All these are about priorities,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
But whose priority?
Yes.
and then the last one. What's this one about?
The police stuff.
Resistance.
Resistance?
Law.
Law?
Control.
Control?
Oppression.
Oppression? Okay. So you sort of get the point that the same event gets framed and interpreted in many different ways, So let's sort of look at this. Where this comes from and what we do about it. So this is a little bit of cognitive psychology for those of you in the room who are into this or who are cognitive psychologists. I do want to thank a colleague, Bruce Dayton, for some of this work. But here's the point here, that people's realities are socially constructed. Right? People can look at the same event and have very contradictory ways of seeing it. And those contradictory ways of seeing it will then lead to different ways of dealing with the conflict. So if I see the conflict as oppression, I'm going to deal with it differently than if I see this situation as economic development. But I think the key thing is these are socially constructed. And the way we see these events are rooted in our identities, our values, and our experiences. So that's maybe the first point. The second point is that what we're hearing when people tell these stories, when I tell you my story of the Dakota Pipeline, my story about the past election, my story about what's happening in the city of Syracuse, what you're really hearing are my frames, right? You're hearing how I organize, perceive, and communicate about a reality. That's my framing. And of course, it's highly subjective. It's a subjective, you know, it's mine. It's highly individual. If we look at politics, if we take it to the next level, when you think about how framing affects politics, people will often say that politics is actually a struggle about naming, framing, and blaming. So I'm gonna give you some examples here. Here's one version of the Dakota Pipeline. It's vandalism on steroids. This is a transition away from fossil fuel and into a renewal economy, right? So this is a positive sort of framing of what's going on here from an activist. Robert Reich, There's no excuse for military tactics being used on behalf of a private corporation that's benefiting from government lands against peaceful protesters, right? So you can see, again, naming, framing, shaming. Right. If we go to, the recent view here, remember what Trump did is he approved this, and so the Dakota Pipeline is now happening. Right here, you had a controversy, right? According to The Guardian, Trump's backing has nothing to do with his personal investments, everything to do with promoting policies that benefit all Americans versus Greenpeace, who looks at the same event and says this is crony capitalism. All right? So the framing is around us. Our politics are often based on this notion of how we react to framing and conflicting frames. And the scary thing, as you know, is it's not about facts, right? It's not about facts. And so this is from a recent study. There have been hundreds of studies. This is a recent study, 2014. A psychologist was studying climate change and found out that, in fact, some of the big resistors to climate change were extremely knowledgeable about the facts. They knew all the facts about climate change. They chose not to believe the facts. Now, why is that? Because as it says here, they're not willing to endorse consensus when that consensus of facts contradicts their political or religious views. This finding helps us understand why my colleagues and I have found that factual and scientific evidence is often ineffective at reducing misperceptions and can even backfire on issues like weapons of mass destruction, healthcare reform, and vaccines. With science, as in politics, identity often trumps facts. Right? Scary? Okay, to make it even slightly more scary, complex situations with a high degree of uncertainty, right? We don't know. We don't know what's going to happen in North Korea. We don't know if climate change is as bad as we think it is, right? High degrees of uncertainty and a lack of agreement on these basic worldviews are highly susceptible to conflict because of frame discordance. And let me give you my picture of frame discordance. So what it's saying is, if we both frame the situation the same way, we understand it the same way, right? This is a conflict about indigenous rights. That's it. We agree. We can communicate really well, right? Because we have the same framing of that event. But what this is saying is, the farther apart our framing is, the more susceptible to conflict, and the more likely that we're not going to be able to hear each other, right? We're not going to be able to hear each other. So again, as it says, the more discordant, the less ability to hear each other, and the less agreement to reach agreement. So often, we have to work backwards to figure out the frame because we live in a world of solutions, right? We live in a world of people saying, we should do this, we should do this, we should do this. And in order to figure out the framing, we have to say, why? Why are they saying that? What do they believe? How are they framing that issue which would lead them to that particular solution? And that brings us to the notion that if we want to engage in bridging understanding, we have to be open to being open-minded. Right? Very hard to do when we frame it completely differently. Very hard to do. And this is a great quote from Oliver Wendell Holmes, where he basically defines open-mindedness this way: every now and then a person's mind is stretched by a new idea or sensation and never shrinks back to its former dimensions, right? That's what true open-mindedness is, the ability to actually change, not just to hear, but to actually change our ideas based on what someone else has said. So how do we do this? All right. I'm going to sort of talk about, again, our choice of how we approach a conflict, as well as some skills. But here's the good news. The good news is that because these frames are coming out of experience, because they're socially constructed, they can change. Right? That's why we do this kind of work in the world, because people can actually change the way they think about things. It's not immutable. So that's why we're going to go to, well, how do we potentially create that sort of understanding? And the first thing is how we approach the other, how we think about approaching the conflict. And we have choices. So many of you have probably seen this basic grid of how one approaches a conflict. And if you're interested, I've asked Eileen after this session to mail out a conflict self-assessment so you can all figure out if you have a particular preference for one of these styles. But what this is really saying is that many of us are not conscious of the fact that as we move into conflict, we may click into a particular approach. And the approaches fundamentally are between concern for people or relationship, concern for getting what we want. Right? And again, all of these are fine. These are choices. If we choose to get what we want, then we're going to move into a controller advocate. Right? It's I must win. It's a win-lose. My position is right. Their position is wrong. And I'm going to move into persuasion and potentially, if I have it, power. I'm going to use my power, you know, just as the students right now are using their power to try to convince government to do something about guns. They're in a controller advocacy win-lose mode. Nothing wrong with it. Very important. They're not in a listening mode. They're in a telling mode, because they're pushing their point of view. They're in a persuasion mode. There are times where you may decide, even though you're not in agreement, that the relationship is so important that you're willing to give on the position. Right? And there are situations where, to move ahead, you have to do that. Even though you violently disagree with somebody, you've said, you know, we're not moving forward without some level of relationship, and so I'm going to give in on this one, not going to try to convince, because I know that's going to be important. And I think we're seeing some of that in Congress right now, right? They're trying to build enough relationship to do something, and so in some cases you're seeing accommodation, and in other cases you're seeing compromise, right? A kind of mini-win, mini-lose. The other choice is to walk away. Right? That's a legitimate choice. Right? There are times when distancing yourself is probably the right thing to do, because you feel like you can't win. You feel like it's too contentious. It's just not the right time to walk into that situation. And then what we're going after, of course, is the collaborative approach where we have an ability to talk at the level of interest. Not just position, not just what I want, but we have an ability to talk about why we want it. Again, we might not reach agreement, but at least we're understanding each other at a kind of fundamental level. So that's the first thing, is to be thinking strategically about how I want to approach this conflict. And of course, I'm making it sound really easy, right? And that's why number two is this thing called emotional intelligence, which, you know, many of you may have been reading about. Emotional intelligence basically says to do this kind of thing is really tough from an emotional point of view. And therefore, if you're going to, you know, move into this, you have to be aware of your own emotions, the other person's emotions, and the buttons, that dynamic back and forth of that person's pushing my button, I'm pushing their button, what's happening to the, you know, the emotional level of the conversation. And then it also takes empathy. Notice, empathy. I actually, even though that I disagree with that person, they're a human being. I haven't dehumanized them. Empathy. And then a variety of skills, which we're going to talk about in a minute. So again, emotional intelligence. What are your buttons? What is going to make you crazy? And then what are your mental models, which we'll get into in a minute. And I've got John Oliver. I love John Oliver. Listen to this quote. I care about facts the way I care about oxygen and imbibing enough water a day to live. Everyone should care about facts. That is something all of us should agree on. Okay, that's his, not just his mental model, that's his button. He goes insane when people are not factual. Right? And it works on television because he doesn't have to really reach agreement or understand anybody. But in reality, that button, you know, that mental model can be a problem. Right. So what's a mental model? Again, a mental model are these assumptions that we create from experience. Right? These are not stereotypes. Stereotypes can come out of families, can come out of hearsay. Mental models literally come out of experience. What happens is we have an experience and we generalize, we categorize, as psychologists say, we put people into categories. And once we do that, we are then filtering reality through those categories, right? So let's say that everybody I have ever met who wears a necktie is brilliant. So I know that when Minch Lewis opens his mouth, it's going to be brilliant, right? On the other hand, you know, everybody I've met, who am I going to insult now? Everybody that I've met who wears blue is a troublemaker. So I know when Eric says something, you know, I'm not going to listen. So the power of mental models is frightening. This is the research that indicates that scientists ignore facts. Unconsciously ignore facts that don't agree with their hypotheses, right? This is the mental model literature that says that mental models allow us to filter things in ways that we're not even aware of. So therefore, part of this emotional intelligence says we have to become aware of our mental models or we're not going to hear things from people because we've already put them into categories. So very powerful stuff. So that's the first thing. Choose your conflict style. Think about the emotional intelligence piece. How do you sort of deal with your emotion? How do you become conscious of mental models? And then this one, which is also so hard, which is rather than telling people, ask questions. Sounds simple, right? But in the heat of the moment, when you have your point of view and that other person has their point of view, we all click into advocacy, right? We want to convince them that we're right. Whether we use facts or whatever, we want to convince people we're right. That, of course, is going to inhibit understanding. The only way of creating understanding is by asking questions, right? Why do you feel that way? What was your experience that led you to that conclusion? Right. So inquiry. And we teach people inquiry when we go to the Middle East. We teach them inquiry. Right? Because in the Middle East, the culture is very much a persuasion advocacy culture. So what do? We spend a lot of time teaching people how to ask questions. We teach people a lot on listening. Right? Well, we should all listen. We have ears. Why can't we listen? Well, listening is really hard because when people are talking to us, what are we actually doing? Are we listening? Anybody, what do you do when someone talks to you? What are you actually doing? You're preparing your response. And everybody knows it, right? Because remember, body language is estimated to be 70% of human communication. So you know it. You can see it. You can feel it when that person is in there. You can see them. They're preparing their response. They're not listening to you. Huh? So therefore, we train people in what's called active listening, reflective listening, empathetic listening. Comes out of therapy. Those of you who've been able to be privileged to have therapy, you know this technique, right? It's simply the technique of disciplining yourself, not only to listen, to pick up the body language, pick up the feeling, but to then feed it back to the person, to be a mirror, right? To become a mirror for that other person. You're concerned that immigrants might use bombs like in Europe. You're concerned about safety. Why is that? So this combination of reflecting what the person said and then asking the follow-up question, why, is immensely powerful in building understanding. Reflective listening, as you know, shows people respect. They know when you do this, number one, they know you listen to them because you're repeating or summarizing what they said. But number two, it's a sign of respect. It's a relationship builder. And then, of course, the other communication technique, which you all know, but which is incredibly important to bridging understanding, is the feedback and summarizing. It's another form of listening, right? When you say to someone, you know, when you say to me that my ideas are stupid, it makes me feel disrespected. I respect your ideas and would like us both to feel respected, right? You're putting it out there. These statements tend to be behavior impact, right? Behavior impact. When you do this, when you say this, this is the impact it has on me, right? This is open, honest communication. You're putting it out there. Summarizing, you believe refugees are a threat to security because bombs went off in Europe. I believe they're an asset to the community. Is that where we are? Can we talk about that? Can I talk about my point of view? Right? So that combination of feedback, right? The ability to really say to people what's the impact of their behavior on you. And then summarizing and moving on with inquiry. Again, are techniques that we teach to try to bridge understanding. And then, as I said before, we live in this world of positions, right? We advocate positions. Do this. I want gun control. I want freedom for guns. I want fossil fuel. I want renewable fuel, right? We live in a world of positions. But if we're in positions, we're either going to wind up in conflict, and our conflict style is either going to be controller, if I have enough power, I can get my way, or maybe compromise, right? Compromise is positions, positional bargaining. But you might not be actually dealing with the real problem, right? The real problem for someone might not actually be about refugees or immigrants. The real problem for them might be about fear, might be about security, financial security, right? So to bridge understanding, you have to have the conversation about the real problem. And it's not easy to get at it sometimes, because as my metaphor indicates, sometimes the real problem is underneath the iceberg. But when you hear enough of these framings sometimes, you realize, wow, you know, what's going on? Why are they framing these issues the way they're framing them? And then there's the why question. And if you can have that why conversation and start talking about what people really care about, fundamentally, it opens space, right? It moves people away from positions, and it potentially opens space for richer conversation. Maybe not agreement, but at least richer conversation and relationship building. So again, as we say, going after agreement and affirming fundamental agreement is going to build some level of relationship. So for instance, okay, we both believe America should be safe, right? We both believe America should be safe. We both agree that families being together are good. We both agree that the melting pot is something that we are proud of in America. right? Affirming the agreement. Often in these situations, people go after the disagreement. And you're done. You've automatically moved into conflict. So what this is saying is spend time trying to figure out where's their fundamental agreement so, again, you can then have the richer conversation. Right. And then finally, respectful closure. Right? Sounds crazy, right? Respectful closure. But you've seen people leave conflict. It's not respectful, right? I'm going to throw down my book and leave the room, right? Respectful closure. Thank you. Thank you for having this conversation with me. Right? I've learned a lot from you. You know, we don't agree, but I've actually learned a lot from you, and I appreciate that. Or what do you think of our conversation, and should we continue? Right. So respectful closure, that again, hopefully creates more opportunities for conversations. So let me just go back to this notion of reframing, because in essence, this whole presentation has been about reframing. Reframing the other, right? That the other is a human being. It's my grandmother, it's my uncle, it's my brother, it's a neighbor, it's another human being, it's another woman, it's another person who wears glasses, right? It's some person I can identify with. Critical versus it's the enemy. It's the person who's stealing my tax dollars. It's the person who's gonna threaten America, right? Dehumanization. The validity of their interests. Right? Respect for the validity of people's interests. I do not agree with your position, but I respect your interests. I respect the fact that you care about safety. I respect the fact that you care about a strong economy. I don't agree with adding $60 billion or whatever it is to the defense budget, but I can agree that safety is a core issue that we share. And then creating the space to move, being conscious of when you have frozen the conversation. And as I said before, it's often those positional arguments, advocacy, that will freeze the conversation. Right? So that's it. So again, let me repeat. For me, it's really, first of all, about listening and understanding the framing. It's about choosing how I want to approach the conversation. And then finally, it's being very conscious of my mental models, my emotion, and developing some pretty conscious skills to try to create a conversation that bridges understanding. So thank you. Questions?
Catherine, I feel like I need to take my tie off before I ask. The framing and everything is aimed at understanding and move, but the issues really are that we need to engage in something that creates action. So, I mean, do you find from your experience that this kind of open dialogue then ultimately has a chance of actually changing positions?
Yeah, so it's a good point. Yes, because, again, as the cognitive psychologists say, we have the ability to change our framing. We can change. And experience, you know, we have our dialogue people here, our interfaith folks and others who engage in dialogue work. That's the purpose of that kind of stuff, that the more people talk to each other, the more likely they are to understand different framing and to be able to reach more complex integrative solutions. That's the point of this. Now, it doesn't mean that person's going to do everything I want, right? It means that now we're sort of entering each other's space, and as a consequence of doing that, we may have the ability to build collaborative solutions, right? And those are defined as solutions that take into account the interests of all the parties. Right, so we have to be open to not getting what we want, but getting something that addresses a more core issue. So yeah, but the only way, frankly, as I said, of moving to that is to start with these kinds of conversations. We don't move to integrative solutions if we're only in advocacy, because advocacy is about my position or your position. It's either or. And I'm not saying, by the way, you shouldn't be an activist advocate. You need to decide, when am I what? When is advocacy serving my need? And when is an understanding, when is building understanding conversations going to be more effective?
At what point does agreeing to disagree actually begin to erode the path to some resolution?
I think the agreeing to disagree usually ends a positional conversation, right? And that's the danger zone. So if you find yourself saying, let's agree to disagree, it means you've been having a positional conversation. And that's okay if that's all you want, but you haven't moved it to the level of really understanding what's going on. So that's a great kind of emotional intelligence signal that if you find that that's the end of the conversation, you have a choice. You can leave it there, or you can say, wow, I haven't really moved this to understanding what's more fundamentally going on for that person. And they haven't heard me at a fundamental level as well. And by the way, you don't have to have relationship with everybody.
Good morning. When does money raise its ugly head in all of this? And I'm thinking right now of the students who are very active on the gun control issue,
yeah,
versus the lobbyists who have the money to control the dialogue.
That's right. So if I am the NRA, I am going to stay right over there in the controller because I have money. I have power. So if I'm the students, I've got to figure out strategies to equalize that power, because the NRA, it's very unlikely, I think. I mean, I don't know the NRA that well, but knowing the tactics that they have used, which have been smack in the win-lose, right? We're going to get our way, we're going to fund elections, we're going to threaten, et cetera. They've been very win-lose tactics. If I'm the NRA, I'm probably going to stay there, because they realize the students have much less power. So I don't think for the students, if they're dealing with the NRA as their opponent, so to speak, you know, they've got to figure out, how do I equalize power here, which is going to be very tough. But the students are smart. They're not persuading the NRA. You don't persuade the NRA. They're going to be entering into, I think, much more sophisticated tactics of figuring out where are their allies, right? Where are the people who share their interests, share their points of view, and then figuring out if they can somehow equalize power and persuasion through building other sorts of alliances. So yeah, power is huge, and hopefully the students are being well advised by power people. Yes, sir.
Here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Catherine, it seems that timing, when to have these conversations, is important.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts about how to gauge appropriate timing?
I think for me, it's an interesting question. I think if we're talking about bridging the divide kind of communication, it gets at the emotional intelligence piece, right? It gets to understanding where are people in a kind of emotional place where you can have a conversation, right? If people are screaming and yelling and really insane, you're not going to have the kind of conversation, you know, that we're sort of talking about. So from this point of view, timing has a lot to do with emotional readiness. Your emotional readiness, right, as well as the sort of emotional readiness of the other party.
Good morning.
Hi.
The question I have has to do with when you talk about facts. Because most people, when you bring up the word facts, they go to a position where they feel their facts are unassailable. I'm right. In some kind of position that there is only one group of facts.
Yeah.
But in most cases, there's alternative facts.
You could,
and I don't, no, people are laughing like the other facts are wrong. I can say in the Middle East, Did the Israelis have a series of facts
absolutely
on their side, and the Palestinians have a series of facts on their side?
That's right.
They might have to do with something that they're factual 2,000 years ago, but they're factual.
Yeah.
So you don't doesn't mean that the other person's facts are made up, but they're a different set of facts that have to be taken into consideration, too. And I think too often people think, well, my series of facts supersede your series of facts, therefore I'm right, you're wrong. So how do you deal with facts in the fact that there are usually a lot of different facts that are into play on controversial issues?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think that's what this is saying, that, you know, we can argue all day long about whose facts are right. I mean, and often sources of data are the source of a conflict. Right. We have different facts, we have different data, and we're just going to fight all day long about that, right? Because we're never going to agree with each other that my facts are wrong and your facts are right. So what this is saying is you have to let go of it, right? You have to let go of that argument and try to move it to a more fundamental argument. Why do we even, well, what are those facts pointing to? And why do we care about that? And then we can have a conversation. But if we stay at the level of arguing facts, it's over. And then furthermore, as the psychologists find over and over again, identity and beliefs trump facts every time. So if I have an identity, whether it's a religious identity, a cultural identity, a professional identity, that says that those facts cannot be right, they conflict, they cannot be right, I'm going to go with that identity, whether it's a political ideology. So that's why we see all the time this frustration of people. Here are the facts. How can they ignore these facts? Well, guess what? They are going to ignore the facts because those facts are not being, they don't fit. They don't fit in that cognitive framing, that identity framing, whether it's political, religious, cultural, whatever that framing might be.
I think what you're offering is very helpful at an interpersonal level.
Yes.
I'm just thinking about group interaction and the fact that it seems as though more and more of our time is spent in isolated or in spaces or places where we're isolated from people with different points of view or different value sets or whatever have you. I even think about TMR and the fact that there is a prevailing set of values here,
yes.
I think, that reflects only part of the broad spectrum of, so how do we create those places or spaces that bring people together with significantly varied points of view?
Yeah, I think it's challenging. And you make the key fact that when people are separate, that allows them, therefore, to just reinforce their belief systems because they're not getting that cognitive dissonance, right? So if my whole experience, I mean, Israel-Palestine is a classic example. I've been there a number of times. How many of you have been to Israel? A lot of you? One of the challenges of the Israeli-Palestinian, there are many, and I'm not taking sides here, but there's a wall, and there's a whole generation of Israelis who've never met Palestinians who live in Palestine. And that's relatively new. The older generation actually had much more freedom of movement. This generation does not have freedom of movement. So you have an entire generation of people who have never met a Palestinian. And it's been terrible for the sorts of things we're talking about because they have no cognitive dissonance, right? They need to meet someone from the other side that, and all of a sudden they have to say, wow, this is not what I thought it was going to be. This person is not who I thought they were going to be. So if you don't get that cognitive dissonance, right, that challenging of everything you thought you knew, then there, you're not going to get the reframing, right? You're not going to get that change in framing. You know, how do you do it? I mean, dialogue, I suppose, hire Interfaith Works. TMR, you know, maybe doing more to get students from the university joining you or in more intentional design. It's extremely tough because when people do come to those sorts of events, they often come in an advocacy mode, right? I'm here to convince the other that I'm right. Let's have a debate. This is not debate. So I don't have a great answer for that, because it's hard to do. You can do it, but it's got to be very, very intentional.
Hi.
Hi.
When we talk about timing and emotions, when you have a certain frame, you're very passionate about that frame and your stance on it. How do we understand more about our emotions going into this conversation and looking at the other's emotions? Is there ways to, neutralize them?
Neutralize them. Well, I'll tell you, some of these techniques are neutralizing techniques. So reflective listening is not just for the other person, but it gives the speaker, so let's say I'm really riled about something. I'm listening to this person, and they're really, I can feel it. I'm going up, right? If I engage in reflective listening where I have to discipline myself to listen, I'm actually going to the left side of my brain, right? Emotions in the limbic mode or whatever. When I engage in reflective listening, I'm in the left side of my brain. I'm in the analytic side of my brain, which actually brings emotion down and gives me time. Gives me time. So a lot of these techniques that we're talking about, these communication techniques, have the added value of lowering, the emotion for the speaker. The other is you probably have techniques. Some of you do deep breathing, right? Some of you have your anchoring technique, where when you feel yourself going crazy, you pull your ear or you do something to bring yourself down. So, there's lots of different techniques that people use for becoming emotionally balanced in a situation. But again, what emotional intelligence says is it should be conscious. You have to be consciously thinking, I'm starting to lose it, consciously realizing that when you say this word, the other person gets upset, right? And then you choose, do I make them more upset? Or do I choose to pull away from that? Right. So it's that real intentional, conscious understanding of emotion that emotional intelligence is talking about.
Good morning. Being that it's 2018, I think a lot of these conflict conversations happen via social media.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you have advice on how to make it a collaborator conversation through that channel.
Yeah, I mean, it's really challenging. I mean, the research on whether or not you can have meaningful conversation via social media, virtual, really, no one's quite figured that out. We do know it exacerbates conflict big time, because the tone, right, the tone that gets used, even if it's just office email, the tone can make people insane. Because people don't do the niceties on email, right? Thank you, dear so-and-so, please. We do sound bites, do this, do this, do this, and we pray that that we know each other well enough to get away with what's really rude conversation that we would never use in person, right? Would you ever talk to someone the way you write your emails? Of course not. And of course, social media is worse. So, I mean, I do think that there are some interesting dialogue platforms that people are using to try to replicate productive dialogue via social media. But I think you have to be in that sort of circle in order, and it takes work, because social media has this tendency, of course. Twitter's the worst. It's the worst. How do you be nice on Twitter? So again, I think what you're doing is replicating what we talked about, listening, inquiry, using reflective listening online, asking those questions, summarizing on it's the same stuff, but you're replicating it for an online environment, which actually takes a lot more work. But the good news is there are these collaborative platforms now where people are gathering online to engage in dialogue, not just debate.
I'd just like to give some examples, sort of in response to what the question Peter asked about some forums that I think have worked at Oasis, and this has also happened elsewhere at SU, Maxwell Lectures. sometimes there are several people talking about a controversial issue.
Mm-hmm.
At Oasis recently, we had people talking about, you know, pros and cons, representing both sides on the question of whether to have a constitutional convention at New York State, the military use of drones. These people were respectful of one another, and they were knowledgeable about, you know, their side and the other position, and the people listening got a lot more information.
Yep.
And I think they came away better informed and more open to dialogue with the, you know, with the other side.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. So I just to reiterate, I mean, the more you can have different positions represented in a respectful way, you know, that's sort of the beginning of understanding the framing piece. It may not change people's minds, but at least you're saying, okay, now I know what's out there, why it's out there, and I think that is absolutely the beginning. So that's a great point.
Please join me in thanking Catherine for joining us today.